It's Thursday night, and as always, we'll start with our film reviews. Three films for you this evening, two of which are video game related. The first began life as a tabletop role-playing game, Dungeons & Dragons, Honor Amongst Thieves. It takes us on an epic quest. Is there any other kind of quest these days? And this is to retrieve, guess what, a long-lost relic. Next up, any kids of the early 1990s will without doubt remember the name Tetris, the addictive handheld video game that swept the world three decades ago. Our second movie tells the remarkable story about how the game was developed and marketed throughout the world. The movie is simply entitled Tetris. And finally then, Night of the 12th is a French film, true crime procedural drama based in Grenoble. Caro Doherty, Donald Clark have been to the cinema for us. And let's start with Dungeons and Dragons, Honor Among Thieves. This is not a film from the stable of the Marvel universe, although you could be forgiven for thinking so with the title of it. And when you talk about a tabletop game becoming a film, Donald, you kind of think, is there much really traction in that?
Well, you also think, is there anything else left to adapt? I mean, the phrase is intellectual property, IP. We're now at the stage where we're going back to 50-year-old role-playing games. I don't know if you remember this phenomenon, but it's been around ever since. But, I mean, before... when it came to role-playing, what's now called role-playing games now essentially is a term for a particular type of video game. But at that stage in the early 70s, that you had to have a dungeon master to plot all this out, and you had... I played a bit of this. I never got sufficiently into it to become any kind of expert. You had polyhedral dice, which you used for the battles, and it required an enormous amount of work to construct these imaginary worlds. Anyway, 50 years later, we've got the second film, or the second... It was a series of films at the start of the millennium. There have been video games based around that game. There was a cartoon series, which was quite popular as well. So you're not only are you asking the question, why are we adapting this 50-year-old role-playing game? You're asking the question, is that what we're really adapting? Or are we really making the various versions that come in between? And nothing about it is very promising. But this just goes to show, if you get the right people on board and they take the correct attitude towards the project, which is, we're making a film first, we're not making a tribute to to whatever this IP we're hacking away. We're actually first of all concerned with making a film that functions as a film, then you can have a successful product, which they have, this thing has worked out far better than we could possibly have imagined.
Yeah, well, when I kind of set it up, I thought, could this really be as good as everybody's saying it is? And Cara, I think you're in a similar boat when it comes to this film as Donald. Maybe explain to us who Chris Pine is and what he's doing here. First of all, he's in a bad enough foul state, to be fair to the character, as the film begins. Edgin Darvis, is that how I say his name, the character?
Poor old Edgin. He's a harper, which means he's part of a secret society. He has lots of enemies, and the enemies, they kill his wife, and they leave him and his little daughter, Kira, who he's very much struggling, he's grieving, he's become a drunk, and he's a bit of a disaster area. And he knows two things. He knows if he has to protect this child, but he also knows there is a doohickey, the Tablet of Reawakening, and if he can find that, he can bring his wife back. But that's easier said than done, because he's become very fond of the owl ale. So he's in the tavern, drowning his sorrows, when he comes across Holga Kilgore, played by Michelle Rodriguez, and she's a barbarian. Now, you think barbarian, she's going to be a bit... evil, but no, she is a barbarian with a big heart, and she falls for this poor drunken fool and the child. Not in they're purely friends, but they form this strange little bond, this little family who are going to raise this child and become professional thieves, which they're very good at until they get caught.
They're doing very well until that happens. One other character I need to know about before I play the clip, Cara, then maybe you'd give me who Simon is in this. This is the Justice Smith character.
Poor old Simon. They need a wizard, and you would think in Dungeons & Dragons there's some really amazing wizards, but poor old Simon, he's more likely to turn you into a frog than save you. He has confidence issues, but they need help, so he gets roped into their merry band. But yeah, he's definitely, he's nervous and he can't quite get his magic to work.
All right, well, let's listen to a clip that features Chris Pine as Ejin, Michelle Rodriguez as Holga, Doric, who's the daughter character played by Sophia Lillis, and Simon, Justice Smith, arrive in a graveyard to question the talisman who's buried in a plot somewhere in there. And that's a graveyard plot rather than the plot of the film. Simon awakens the talisman, and then Ejin, the Chris Pine character, takes over with questions. And it doesn't work out quite as well as he might have hoped.
Okay, Simon, how does this work?
All right. Once the dead man is revived, we can ask him 5 questions, at which point he will die again, mm-hmm. never to be re-revived.
Why 5 questions?
I don't know. That's just how it works.
Seems arbitrary.
Can we get on with this, please?
Right, yes. Perlomon Tergatis. Maybe I'm not saying it right. I wasn't scared, nearly startled.
Here we go. Were you killed in the Battle of the Everhorse?
Yes.
Great. I mean, not for you. Sorry for your loss. 4 more questions, right?
Yes.
No, that wasn't for you. Did that count as a question?
Yes.
Damn it. Only answer when I talk to you, okay?
Yes.
Why did you say okay at the end of that?
I didn't.
Fantastic. Where's the shovel?
That's Chris Pine as Ejin, Michelle Rodriguez in there as Holga, Sophia Lillis as Doric, and Justice Smith as Simon in a scene from Dungeons and Dragons. And immediately I was relieved, Donald, to know you don't get bogged down in plot here. They're having fun with this. But we're part, you know, sometimes these people have fun and you're thinking, that's great, but not, where are we in the equation? They're bringing us with them as they have fun.
It's a pure comedy, and there's no question about that. But it also has a surprisingly successful emotional undertow, particularly towards the end. The relationship between Michelle Rodriguez and Chris Pine is a really nice one. It's that sort of spiky, he's kind of, in many ways, she's playing the male role in traditional terms of the relationship. She's kind of the aggressive, forceful character, and he's the character who needs to be a little bit more seduced as the film moves on. But it works for that reason, as you said, because the comedy is terrific, and the comedy is, in instances like the scene we've just heard, very close to Monty Python and the Holy Grail. But the Sanctum is also very much a romantic thing going on, which suggested to me a certain amount of The Princess Bride. Now, it's not on the scale of the quality of The Princess Bride, but they're certainly kind of travelling in the same territory. And you can get away with an awful lot if you have... if you cast as well as you've cast here, and not least, we haven't yet mentioned Hugh Grant, who's gone through a very interesting cycle over the past 30 years or so. That, I mean, it seems an awfully long time ago, well, it was over 30 years, when he emerged and he was this amiable, bumbling sort in 4 Weddings and a Funeral, and somewhere in there that he gathered this slightly malign quality, as an actor, I stress. Yeah. I'm not talking about Hugh Grant himself, who I'm sure is a lovely individual, but as an actor, he gathered this slightly malign quality. So whenever he appears on the screen, you immediately don't trust, however charming he may be seen to be. And there's actually not a huge distance here between the character he plays here and the character he played in Paddington 2,
right,
where again he is this character who emerged with sort of name from Nancy Mitford and an apparently ingratiating manner. And the minute he appears, you think, yeah, you're a bad one, which he proves to be.
He's called Forge Fitzwilliam, you know,
exactly.
So you know he's called.
That actually telegraphs the fact that this is not a fellow you can trust.
No, let's have a quick listen to him. You got to picture him now on top of a huge pillar in the middle of a Colosseum-style arena, and he's opening what we call the games.
What a profound joy it is to welcome you, the good people of Neverwinter, to the resumption of the High Sun Game. Do not leave the arena till the close of the games, as there will be a wonderful gift for each and every one of you.
All right, take me down. This is absurdly high. It's not what we discussed.
It's not what we discussed, says Forge Fitzwilliam, played by Hugh Grant in Dungeons and Dragons. And Cara, we're in Northern Ireland. What is it about Northern Ireland and these kind of medieval settings that it seems to love to portray?
The most fantastic landscapes and locations, but actually, one of the things that's different in this is we saw it dark and damp and cold and foggy in Game of Thrones for so long, but in this they shot in the summertime. It's so green, it's so lush. I mean, it just looks magical. So it's definitely seeing Northern Ireland from a much lighter point than we normally see it on screen. Really, absolutely looks fantastic. And what really helps is they built most of the sets. They use practical effects. There's so few CGI. Mm. They created all these fabulous creatures and doohickeys and Watsons. And just that brings that extra dimension of life to it.
There's a clunk and weight to it, I think, which is very satisfying.
And did you, Cara, similar to Donald, did you get that kind of emotional heft towards the end that was possibly unexpected in something that's so lighthearted in many ways?
Very much so. And it is, as Donald said, that Princess Bride way. Yeah, it hits you at a few points. There's a lovely sense of family. Mm. I mean, they're a right bunch of vagabonds and weirdos, but they connect. And that kind of combination of heart and humour, plus some really great action sequences to the end, it has all those magical qualities.
Right, so director John S. Byrd, take a bow, it sounds like, for casting well and for directing well. Stars for you, from you first of all on this one, Cara?
Oh, definitely 4. I could almost edge towards the 4.5, really. And it's so much fun. It's one of those films I want to see again with a bunch of friends. Right. Definitely.
Okay. And Donald?
I'd happily give it 4. I hope people go and see it. I mean, it'd be interesting to see. It's not always easy to get people to see even populist films these days, but we'll see. Certainly, but 4 stars, yes, so no question.
A very solid 4 then from both Donald and Cara. For Dungeons and Dragons. Let us move on then to another film based on a game. This time it's a popular video game. Tetris features falling blocks of colour that feed into our universal desire to create order out of chaos. That's the game we're talking about there. The movie moves away from the game itself to tell the story about how it was first devised, developed and marketed through the world. It's a very different story in that respect, Cara. It's not a kind of a trying to reinvent the game itself or to display the game itself. It's about the politics behind getting one of those games and marketing around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. It turns out that Tetris was designed by an Alexei Pajianov, I'm sure I'm saying that wrong, in Russia in 1984. But it's communism and he can't make money from anything he's designed. So he gives it to friends and colleagues and it takes over Russia. Everyone's playing it. But it's a Hank Rogers, played by Taron Egerton, who is a game developer, and he's a bit kind of charming, a bit kind of shady as well. He discovers the game at a gaming convention in Nevada and buys the rights to sell it and market it in Japan, where he lives with his family. And it's from here that he begins to realize rights are not a straightforward thing, especially when you have other interested parties like Sega, Atari and the Maxwell Media moguls all trying to get their hands to market it in different places. And what they don't actually realize is that sitting in Moscow is a bunch of people who don't quite realise the extent of what's going on in the outside world with their game.
Yeah. Okay, let's have a listen to Taron Egerton as Hank Rogers. And here he is explaining those Soviet origins of the game Tetris.
It all began with a guy named Alexei Leonidovich Pajitnov 4 years ago. By day, he worked as a programmer for the government at the Soviet Computer Science Center. But by night, he invented games for fun. His computer, a Stone Age Soviet piece of crap called an Electronica 60, didn't even have a graphics card. His falling blocks were parentheses pushed together. Alexei and a couple of buddies from work made the game IBM compatible, which meant color graphics, 8-bit music, and floppy disks that people copied and shared for free. It spread like wildfire.
Taron Egerton there as Hank Rogers in the film Tetris. And Donald Clark, I'm wondering about the tone of this film, because there's a feeling of a documentary about it in some ways. There's a feeling of a docudrama about it, but there's also a kind of a comedic tone in there too.
Well, very much so, and I think it functions as a comedy as much as anything else. I mean, if anything, it's a bit too packed. I mean, you hear about this notion, it's odd actually, that there's now a whole kind of stream of films coming our way about the launch of products. Next week, Air comes out about the launch of the Air Jordan, which is also basically about someone trying to get a name on a contract, which is what we have here, which is not necessarily the most promising subject for a film. But it's almost too packed, because, I mean, actually, your first thoughts would be, well, what do I care about how they came to market or how they came to earn the rights to Tetris or any other video game? But in fact, it's got all this stuff stuff woven in. So it has the end of the USSR, which is looming. It has the launch of the Game Boy, which is kind of the product worship part of it all. And it has the Maxwell thing, which is fascinating. And if you're kind of, you know, our sort of age and lived through...
So Robert Maxwell is the kind of the villain of the piece here.
Essentially, yes. I mean, the head of the Mirror Group, who I'd forgotten if I ever knew, but it had an interest in software at this stage. And so we know that down the road, if you knew anything about the Maxwell Group, that in the few years after the incidents in this film, he vanished off the back of his boat after a scandal involving the pensions in the Mirror Group. So that's all looming as well. And so there's enormous potential to do all kinds of anything that's a bit too busy for that reason. Though the one, I think, you know, unquestioned, well, there's a few unquestioned successes. I think Edgerton himself was very good, always a charming actor, and the fact that we know him as that charming version of Elton John. And Eddie the Eagle, in the Eddie the Eagle film, which I really recommend to people if they haven't seen it, it's another example of a film which should be terrible, but it's actually great. But by casting him, you're saying to us, we are identifying with Hank as a hero of the people, because that's one of the things that Taron Egerton does. But the other unadulterated success, I think, in this, or unquestioned success in this, is Roger Allam as Maxwell, who has a whale of a time, no pun intended, with layers of latex on him, you know, fattened up, and he just absolutely revels the opportunity to play this notorious character.
And Toby Jones is in there as well, Cara. He's one of the competitors, or another gamer. Does he want to get his hands on Tetris too?
He does. He's a broker, and he's working for the Maxwells, or is he? Is he working for his own interests? Right. It's a little bit hard. He's part of the convoluted negotiations, but he's embedded in the middle of this. He's in Moscow, and God bless his wit, he is trying to double cross the KGB, which is not going to get you very far.
Not a good plan. And as Donald was describing it too, it sounds like a convoluted story that has the possibility of getting bogged down in itself. Does it do that?
Oh, definitely. It is. It's just unnecessarily convoluted, and the jigs and reels of the rights, that's not straightforward anyway. Yeah. But I just there's too much and too many things getting thrown into it, and that trying to find its balance between comedy and drama, but it muddles itself, and yet it's still enjoyable, but it could have been a far better film.
All right.
Yeah, it's kind of frustrating because it gets a bit lost, and everything in here has the potential to work like gangbusters, even down to the fact that I think they rather overdo the use of the computer graphics. So there's a kind of a gag where you see, like, you know, low grade and also 8-bit video music. Game music being used as the soundtrack and so forth. It's all a bit over-egged. It doesn't pull it apart, but it ultimately always feels like it should be a little bit better.
Stars?
Three.
Three. And what are you saying on this, Cara?
Yeah, I go with three as well. It doesn't always work, but, you know, it just kind of suck you in at times as well.
All right, so three, kind of middle of the road, that sounds like to me. Finally then, The Night of the 12th, a French film, true crime procedural drama is what we're talking about in this case. What is the true crime that has been dealt with here, Donald?
It is the murder, a gruesome murder. I believe it was originally in Paris, of a young girl who is doused in petrol and set alight. A number of police officers then gather and start investigating the various suspects, of which there are many, and all of them seem plausible. It's an interesting structure, this, because I wonder, is it possible for the first thing that you see in a film to count as a spoiler? Obviously, the filmmakers think not, they've got it right there at the beginning.
Yeah.
They tell us that, right at the beginning, that The Night of the 12th is based on an unsolved case. Yet, as a viewer, inevitably, because we're so wired into genre, and wired into this genre in particular, you feel that some kind of resolution is bound to come our way, and maybe it does. To say more than that, well, it would be a spoiler. But what you definitely do get is, I think, quite a fresh take on a very familiar professional structure, that is the procedural drama, played out, I think, in quite elegant lines at quite a leisurely pace. And I think they make some interesting choices here. The decision to move the real-life case, which I think was in Paris, from Paris to Grenoble in the shadow of the Alps, is a smart one. I mean, partly for the trivial reason that you allow these elegant compositions to play out while the action's taking place, and also because it allows Dominic Moll, the director, directed Harry, he's here to help, a decade or so ago, an excellent French director, to focus on the action, free from the distractions of all that metropolitan buzz. And the message, I mean, there's a very strong feminist argument going through this that makes for an interesting crime plot, which is that, essentially, one point, the girl's friend, in what could be a melodramatic point, but actually a melodramatic line, but actually works quite well, says, all men killed her. And you get that sense that a woman you know, blameless woman is killed, and yet, despite that, nonetheless, despite the fact there is no real motive to kill her, there are men all around the place who could have done so and seem likely suspects to have done so.
The other side, as well as the obviously the crime itself and the solving of that crime, or not solving as the case may be in the film, we have to have two police officers. Give me a sense, if you would, Cara, of Johan and is he Marco? The Sebastian Bouillon as Johan and Bouilly Lanners as Marco. Interesting dynamic between these two detectives.
Johan, he's newly commissioned and he's got quite a fresh approach. He's also very diligent. He's kind of ticking every single box. He wants to get to the bottom of this. Marceau is a lot older. He is going through personal issues. He's very melancholic, and both of them are bringing that into work. Marceau, he really is miserable. I mean, his marriage is falling apart. So, but his misery affects the case in a very different way to kind of Johan's need to solve this. And it does show very well how at the end of the day, a crime is committed, but people do inject their personal lives into a case. Because it really goes into that. But kind of Marceau is so laden down by his misery, and Johan, being that bit younger, starts to see how much sexism is in his own unit, as the men they're all men at the start, and every single one of them they're not particularly that fussed about solving this murder, because you know she's just another girl at the end of the day who's been killed possibly by a former lover. And Johan starts to see how very wrong that this kind of continual system and how much it needs to change.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of victim blaming that goes on. But then a character called Nadia joins the investigative team. What does she bring to the mix, Cara?
Well, she's also she is. I think I'm not sure what her heritage is, but she's not. She isn't white, and she has the burden of both that facing an entire squad of men, and she's just sick and tired of everything, and that kind of fires Johan to try and help get this case finally sorted out.
And I guess it both probably displays more misogyny and also gives a chance for a female voice to be brought into the equation. But it is based on facts, so they're not making that bit up. But the other thing about procedurals, Donald, the potential here, a bit like what we were saying about Tetris, the potential to get bogged down in tiny little details, but you need to know each detail to get to the next stage of the crime investigation. Does it manage that?
I think it does. I think it's very clear. I think that in terms of the practicalities of the clues and the structure of the story, if you can call it a story, because it has that it has the random quality of real life, I think it's laid out very clearly, so you always know exactly where you sit. I mean, it has the look of a TV series like Happy Valley or one of the recent filed German adaptations. I would not be the first critic to compare it to Bong Joon-ho's Memories of Murder, which is one of the films that Bong Joon-ho broke through with 10 or 15 years ago. But they all had that kind of more traditional momentum that you have in a crime story. But I think this doesn't have that, but still gets away with it, partly because that environment is so well fleshed out. It economically lays out the tensions in their lives. And also because it's honest about where we're going. It invites you to a surprise or not going.
Yeah.
And there is, towards the end, there's one really strange thing where there seems to be a clue I detected. And nothing happens from it. That's all I'm saying. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, well, give me your stars then on in terms of Night of the 12th. Donald first?
Four.
A solid four from Donald. Where are you on this one, Cara?
I got very annoyed about the fact that this film is basically saying that women should not be judged for their pasts, that their victimhood is not based on their previous relationships. We don't learn anything about Clara. All of it is done through her past. So it's kind of it's just this frustrating thing of not really practicing what it's preaching. It is very good and well acted, but I'm going to go with a 3.5 because I just got very annoyed at that
aspect.
A real life character not actually being anything other than, you know, somebody who slept with lots of people.
Alright, Cara O'Doherty and Donald Clark are two reviewers tonight. The Night of the 12th, Dungeons and Dragons, and Tetris, the three movies.